calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome to our program. It is 6 minutes after the hour, the first hour of our program. Richard Ralston is with us. Richard is, I believe, Richard, you're with the Ayn Rand Institute, right?
The Ayn Rand Institute, yeah, I'm speaking on their behalf today.
AYNRAND.org, the website. And Richard Ralston covers objectivism, volunteerism, foreign policy, journalism, and media for Ayn Rand. And you have some opinions about privatizing health care. Let me just preface this, Richard, if I may, by pointing out to my listeners that Ayn Rand, her book Atlas Shrugged in particular, and some of her shorter essays, The Value of Selfishness, is it? The Virtue of Selfishness?
The Virtue of Selfishness.
Yeah. That Ayn Rand was one of the... One of the major influences, I would say, in what is now obviously led to what is now called objectivism, but then objectivism in large part, not entirely, but in large part then led to the political movement that is known as libertarianism, which has had the Cato Institute and other groups like that have had tremendous impact on what we call today conservatives, modern conservatives. I think that the old line, Sir Edmund Burke and Russell Kirk conservatives, the old William F. Buckley and Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater conservatives really took a huge shift in the 1970s, 1980s as a result of Ayn Rand's influence in the conservative movement. And so you guys are the fountainhead, no pun intended, that being the title of another one of her books, and of a lot of this stuff, although you don't define yourselves as conservatives or politicians or anything like that. So in my opinion, it's important for our listeners to get where a lot of this kind of thinking is coming from. Where does Grover Norquist get his ideas from? You know, yeah. that sort of thing. Not to lump you in with Grover Norquist. Perhaps you're shuddering. I don't know. Maybe you're proud of him.
No, you're entirely right. The Ayn Rand was not political, and in the Ayn Rand Institute, you know, expounds her views that politics is a little premature at the moment, and they take no specific political positions, but that what's important is the underlying moral and political and economic philosophy foundations.
Right, and it's and it's been substantial. I mean, Alan Greenspan, for example, was inducted or initiated into the, I don't know what to call it, the cult, the organization of objectivism in Ayn Rand's apartment in 1956?
You know, the magic word and the secret handshake, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't think he's ever deviated from it, really, in any significant way. He's certainly his economic policies are consistent in large part. His positions have required him to be perhaps a little more pragmatic and a little less idealistic.
Well, I don't know. I think he's never renounced any of his principles. It's just keep it in the context that
he's got to keep a job.
Objectivists would not think that the Federal Reserve System should even exist. So
yeah.
In that context, maybe he hasn't done too bad a job.
Yeah. Okay. So your take on our healthcare system. Let's just start there.
Well, in principle, I can talk either about the principles on which it should be based or what's actually happened in the last few years or what individuals can do to get some more choice.
Well, let's just talk about health care in the abstract for a moment. Historically, health care was not a particularly expensive proposition. We had, you know, people took care of themselves and their own families, home remedies, folk remedies, herbs, herbalists. Everybody knew somebody who knew how to find the right plants or whatever. Back in the old days, I mean, the barber was where you went for minor surgery and to have your blood let every other month
things like that. Yeah, well, it was pre-medicine.
Yeah, well, it was called medicine at the time, and they were quite serious about it, and were actually doing, I mean, you know, serious things like brain surgery and things. But by and large, it wasn't just for the rich, and it wasn't something that was particularly expensive, frankly, and doctors weren't even all that well paid, or even in many ways, not even all that highly regarded. People were terrified of going to the doctor because the odds were, particularly before Louis Pasteur, that you'd get sick and die from an infection the doctor gave you.
Well, that's right. Now, I would say up until about the 1960s, we had the best healthcare system in the world and the cheapest. It started to go wrong in the 1940s when you separated the customer from the payer, when third-party payments started coming in. So
health insurance companies you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well,
employers, basically. Employers providing tax-free insurance coverage to their employees.
Right, and this was a change in law that was pushed through by, I don't recall the year, so I don't know whether it was Roosevelt or Truman, but it was during that era, during World War II and just after World War II, to encourage employers to provide health care insurance to employees, because Harry Truman, it must have been Truman, because in 1947 Truman proposed a national health care system, and the Republicans in Congress shot it down. And so I'm assuming that Truman must have proposed the tax deductibility of health care for companies.
Yeah, they tried to make it taxable, and that started a revolution, and then they said it would be tax-free. Of course, that left everyone without employer-provided insurance to pay for it on their own with after-tax dollars.
So right, whereas a company can pay for it with pre-tax dollars, which is a bizarre situation.
Then up until about the 1960s, though, the government, the federal government, was either providing or paying for about 8% of the health care.
Okay.
Today it's paying for about 50 or 51% of the health care.
Through Medicare, Medicaid, and picking up the cost of, through payments, picking up the cost of uninsured persons who show up in hospital emergency rooms where they charge $600 for a kid who's having an asthma attack that could be cured with a $15 doctor visit if they had health insurance.
Possibly, yes. I mean, All these factors do it. But generally speaking, I think we can agree that they haven't done a swell job at keeping the cost down.
They being?
The federal government, in terms of as their share has gone up, the cost has gone up. Now, there are good reasons for some costs to go up. We're all getting older. The technology is getting more dazzling. Let me just
challenge that premise for a moment. I'm assuming that you know what the overhead of Medicare is.
Awful, yes.
What, 2.5%?
130,000 pages of regulations they're trying to use to enforce price controls.
Right, but for every $100 that goes through Medicare... For every $100 that goes through Medicare, somewhere between $2 and $3 sticks to the finger of the system. That is the cost of administration of Medicare.
Oh, I would say that maybe that's just certain specific direct costs. But I would
no, that's overall. This is looking at the annual federal budget.
Yeah, but the actual cost of cost control, in terms of the administrative burden throughout the whole healthcare system that feeds into that, is much higher.
It's substantial, certainly, but Medicare is one payer. It's a single payer, and so it's not like you've got 30 different companies with 30 different sets of forms. The reality, and trust me, Richard, I can double-check this, the reality is that from year to year over the last two decades, the cost of administration for Medicare has been between 2 and 3%. The cost of administration, if you're just looking purely at the administrative cost, for private health insurance, for-profit corporations, has been slightly less than that, you know, 1.8 to 2.5%. However, out of every $100 that passes through the hands of private health insurance companies, HMOs and PPOs, somewhere between $15 and $30 sticks to their fingers because they have to pay dividends to their stockholders. They have to pay, you know, they have to generate a profit. They have to pay multi-million dollar salaries to their CEOs, things that Medicare doesn't do. They have to pay for the fancy corporate headquarters. They have to pay for the advertising. They have to pay for the sales force that's out there competing with other health insurance companies. They have to pay for the fancy four-color brochures and literature. They have to pay for all the lobbying, the hundreds of millions of dollars, the bribes that they give to politicians, what I would call bribes. Obviously, they don't call them that. They have to pay for the gold-plated faucets in the private jets so that their CEOs don't have to travel with the rest of us in commercial airlines. And so how can you say that that's a good thing?
I don't. One of the biggest myths of healthcare was HMOs, that managed care was the magic wand that would keep costs down. If you remember, the Clinton proposals in 1993 and 1994 held out managed care as the way to keep costs down and would have forced everyone into HMOs.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, looking back, I don't agree with the Clinton proposals because what they were trying to do was put together something that didn't put the insurance companies out of business because they were afraid of them.
By the end of the Clinton administration, I mean, but what managed care means is that by you manage care by limiting it, reducing it, rationing it, overburdened administration of it, and what formulary you take and what formulary you don't, and all those issues. So by the end of the Clinton administration, they were proposing making it easier for people to sue their HMOs for managing.
So the bottom line is you don't think people should have the right to sue their HMOs, and you don't think that health care is a basic human right.
I think that people should have the right to sue anyone they want, and that HMOs were sold as a bill of goods.
So, okay. We've got a ways to go with this, Richard. Can you stick around after the break?
Sure.
I'd like to continue this conversation. We're talking with Richard Ralston with the Ayn Rand Organization, AYNRAND.org. We really haven't gotten to the top subject, which is, you know, really what kind of health care system should we have in the United States? Should health care be a right for all? Should we have a single-payer health care system like every other industrialized country has? We'll find out. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Richard Ralston of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the original thinkers of much of what is today considered the conservative movement. And Richard, let's just cut right to the chase. In every industrialized country in the world, except the United States, healthcare is considered part of the commons, part of the social contracts, part of the thing that we all do for each other. They all follow the advice of Jesus in Matthew 25, you know, that you have to heal the sick, that's the obligation of all of us. And that if any of us is sick, then
Supreme Court justices?
Then all of us are sick. I'm sorry?
Does that apply to Supreme Court justices? Never mind. I couldn't let it go by.
Well, what was your point?
I don't think it is the role of the federal government to enforce the moral principles of Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I'll give you that. But the point is, it's not unique to Christianity. I mean, the idea of healing the sick is something you find in every religion around the world. And the point is that every other country in the world has concluded that healthcare, since it has become high-tech and expensive in the past two or three generations, is part of the commons. It's part of the collective commons. What is your take on it?
Well, in many cases, that means that they think everyone has the right to be on a waiting list. In Canada, you between being referred to it, being referred and being treated by an orthopedic surgeon is 30 weeks. If you have terminal cancer and are referred for radiological treatment, you wait 8 weeks before it starts.
Which is a whole awful lot better, Richard, than being in the United States and having no insurance at all and having no waiting list to get onto.
Well, there are ways.
And we've had people from Canada on this program who say, you know, yeah, that's a lot of propaganda. I lived in Vermont, an hour away from the Canadian border. Not once in the 10 years I lived in that state did I see one or even hear the story of. And I was on the air in Vermont as well throughout this time. Did I see a single Canadian come to Vermont for health care. But every Saturday, busloads.
Los Angeles for health care.
Every Saturday, busloads of Americans were driving up to Canada by pharmaceuticals. Every Saturday.
Well, that's not because the Canadian government is providing the pharmaceuticals to them.
It's because the Canadian government is doing bulk buying.
But the principle is that rather than addressing our health care needs, and there are people who both want health care and can't afford it, and we can discuss ways of addressing that. But the answer is because somebody can't afford it. Do you draft everyone into a regimented, single government-provided healthcare system?
Well, the alternative is to draft everyone into a system. Richard, hang on just a second here. The alternative is to draft everyone into a system where individual corporations are making the decisions. Now, who do you want making the decisions for you? Somebody who's answerable to the board of directors of Kaiser, or somebody who's answerable to the taxpayers and the voters?
If it's a free market, or responsible to the healthcare public employees unions. So there are forces to bear both in government and in private economy. But in a true free market,
there's no such thing as a true free market.
Choices about which we don't have today.
No, and you never will have outside of a little community of maybe 15 or 20 people who are engaged in barter. So, I mean, let's set that one aside.
Oh, no, there's many good, particularly good things coming along now with simple care, which is available to people, or the rapidly growing health savings accounts. Walmart is becoming a provider of health care, which is a trend of in-store.
Why am I not reassured by that, Richard?
I wouldn't get my brain surgery there, but the day-to-day services we need are there. But basically you're saying that your model of efficiency is the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Motor Vehicles, the U.S. Post Office, and that all private corporations are inefficient and bloated. And we'd be all much more better off if we had really efficient government. It would only if we put all of our trust for our health care in the hands of George Bush or in the hands of the United States Congress, we'd all be much better off.
No, I'm suggesting that it be in the hands of we the people. And what you're suggesting, first of all, you're the nice generalizations, but the fact of the matter is, I've worked in big corporations, and you want bloat, you want inefficiency, you want bureaucracy. In some of the largest corporations in America, it makes government, they are so much more bloated and so much more less efficient than many of our government functions. Medicare is more efficient than any health insurance company in the United States. You cannot refute that. It's just that simple. Medicare is answerable to us. If we don't like the way Medicare is working, we say to our elected officials, you fix it or you're out on your butt. Whereas if I try and call up, Kaiser or Aetna or whatever, some health insurance company and say, hey, you got to fix this thing. I want you to pay this bill. They laugh at me and hang up the phone. The person in India that I'm talking to.
Then you get a different insurance company. It's harder to change the federal government.
But because there has been so little enforcement of the anti-monopoly laws, which I know that you're also opposed to, you're opposed to the anti-monopoly laws. You end up with these giant corporations who they're not responsive to us, and they don't give a damn.
And the federal government is very loving and responsive, and really gives a damn, like in New Orleans.
The federal government is us. The federal government, yes. What happened in New Orleans was the result of the Bush administration following your doctrine and saying, oh, let's starve the beast. Let's not give money to FEMA. Let's not plan for emergencies. And it created a self-fulfilling prophecy.
But I thought the Clinton administration had already taken care of all that.
Well, they did. And then Bush rolled it back. James Lee Witt was doing a great job. He knew how to deal with disasters. Clinton puts in a guy who does liposuction on horses.
So Bush has really pared down the size of the federal government.
Well, that's not my point. We were talking about Louisiana. Anyhow, Richard Ralston, AYNRAND. Thanks for being with us, Richard.
You're welcome.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
Oh, even with your Medicare bill.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate.
Oh, yeah.
You gave them the old hope. Hocus, you misdirected them with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back, my friends. Yes, just so long as I'm a dictator. It is 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Is health care a basic human right in modern society? Should we collectively be taking care of us? Or should it be every man for himself and every woman for herself and every child for themselves? Should it be that the rich get wonderful care and the poor, you're poor. Tough luck. Is that the way it should be? Clearly that's the way the conservatives think it should be. And in fact, inserting this poison pill into the Medicare bill Well, let's provide people with prescription drug coverage with this funny donut in it and all this weird stuff. And by the way, the government can't negotiate prices. So the pharmaceutical companies will make $300 billion extra in profits, and it'll bankrupt the government. And then everybody will say, well, I guess we can't have Medicare anymore. We have to just privatize the whole thing. I mean, that's the direction that we're going, and that's the direction that they very much want to go. And it's crazy. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, Terry in Alberta, Canada, on the line. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Terry?
Well, I was just listening to your comments from your guy from the RAND Corporation. He talked about the way our healthcare system works up here, and he's out to lunch. It's all propaganda. That's the honest truth.
Okay, you're Canadian. You use the Canadian healthcare system?
You betcha.
Do you have to wait in line for months and months and months to see a doctor and that kind of thing?
Hell no. That isn't the way it works. He's talking about, you're saying that there's a 30-week wait for orthoscopic surgery or anything like that. That isn't the way it works. For elective stuff, say, for example, you want to you have to get a hip replaced. Well, there may be a waiting list of, you know, 4 weeks or whatever for a normal one. But if you want one of the fancy titanium ones, which would be elective for you, then you might wait longer. But if you hurt yourself, you're in and out the next day. I know I've done it myself. I blow my ankle and my knees apart. The same time it happens, you're fixed.
Yeah.
There is no huge wait. And when they say that, they look at the worst case, say somebody wants something done electively.
Somebody wants a nose job. They're going to have to wait for that.
Exactly.
If they want the taxpayers to pay for it.
Exactly. And it isn't just the taxpayers. We do pay premiums. I think I pay $100 every 3 months, $110, not exactly me, my wife, and my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also health plans that you get through work or whatever on top of your basic care, like that'll look after, say, your eyeglasses and, you know, fancy dental work. But that's purely elective. Every citizen is guaranteed health care. And there's no other way you can have a system. Like, we watched you guys, like, we get a lot of your media and everything. You know, like, Sirius is a good example. And we watch what happens down there, and we just shake our head. Like,
yeah.
You should be pushed out of a hospital if you don't have a checkbook with you.
Yeah, except that's what happens. That's what happens.
Or you
get pushed into a public hospital where, you know, it's a hellhole.
Well, all we have is public hospitals. There's a few private clinics that do the odd thing, and, like, you can get physiotherapy at private clinics and whatnot, but...
Right, but here in the United States, what we've done is we've created ghettos out of our private our public hospitals, and our private hospitals have become, you know, basically places for those people who have very good health insurance programs.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
Where I live in Alberta, we get a lot of American travel going up to Alaska. It's right along the Alaska Highway, and I've got some friends who work in our hospital, and, you know, we get quite a few Americans, and they love the quality of care. Like they say, they can't believe it. You go in, you might wait an hour in the emergency room. You know, depending, you know, first come, first serve, whoever's
sure.
Hurt type thing. But, you know, they all say, you know, it's nothing like what they've all been led to believe the way our health care is. And
yeah.
Every
yeah.
time we hear it on the radio, it just gets sick of hearing, oh, it's horrible. You know, we line up in pits and wait for days for help. But that isn't the way it is.
Yeah. Well, Terry, thank you for educating us. I appreciate that. And thank you very much for calling. I've never used the Canadian health care system. I have used the British health care system. We were traveling once and our daughter got sick. And she had quite a fever. We didn't know what the deal was. Her throat was all inflamed. She was 12, 13 years old at the time. And we were in London. And I had to give a speech that evening. I came back. It was about, I don't know, 11 o'clock or so at night. We called the local surgery, right, the local small hospital. The doctor who answered the phone, we talked over the phone about what was going on with her. He says, I'll be right over. And we're like, what? And he says, well, you know, it's the end of my shift. I'm on my way home. I'll be right over. I'll just drop by. You don't need to bring her in. He came over to the house of the people that we were staying with and said, yeah, you don't have to take her out of the bedroom or anything. You know, we can just go in there. We don't have to disturb her. And so we're all standing around her bed, and he's checking out her throat and stuff, and he opens his black bag, and he gives us a bottle of antibiotics. He says, it looks to me like she's got strep throat or whatever it was. I forget what it was. And he says, here's the antibiotics, and here's everything you need. And I'm great. How much do I owe you? And he says, oh, you don't owe me anything. This is, you know, we have, you know, everybody's covered here. And he said, and, you know, you're a guest of our country, and so you're covered as well. And all you have to do is just sign this form saying that I provided you with the service so that I can get my paycheck. And it was just that simple. And the guy was there in an hour. And we lived in Germany for a year, I've used the German healthcare system several times myself. Our kids all used it. And you make a doctor's appointment. Sometimes you have to wait a few days. Sometimes you have to wait a week. I mean, try and make a doctor's appointment in the United States in less than a week. And it was just no different, except that you just give them your number, your equivalent of a Social Security number over there, and then they write it down, and that's it. That's it. So, anyhow, 1-866-440-THOM. Steve in West Memphis, Arkansas. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Now, I'm a cool-hearted Republican, but I have a few problems with the national health care system. One, right, if I was a doctor, if I had the brains to be a doctor, which I don't, right, why would I spend all that time to be a doctor and all that work just to get by? Because nobody's going to get rich working for the government.
So you think that the only reason somebody should become a doctor is to become rich? Because the doctors that I knew, in fact, the place where I lived in Germany, in the city of Steinach, I lived at a place called Kinder- und Jugendhilfsversalmen. They ran a health clinic there, and they had a doctor, Dr. Geert, who was on staff. And he made the equivalent of maybe U.S. $160,000. Doctors, you know, they're doing okay. It's like the top end of the middle class. And that's pretty much fixed by the government. So you think that the only reason somebody should go into medicine is to get rich?
Well, I'm just saying, look, if I had the brains to be a doctor, and if you just got by as being a doctor, where I can make a ton of money using my brains to be an engineer, I'm going the engineer route.
Well, let me flip that around, Steve. If you got sick, would you rather go to somebody who only became a doctor because he wanted to get rich, or would you rather go to somebody who became a doctor because he felt that it was a calling to heal people?
Well, if he's rich, it probably means he's capable. I'd rather go.
How do you know? How do you know?
Because he became rich, which means he's probably a good doctor.
He might just be a good marketer.
Being a doctor.
He might just be a good marketer. He might be a good hustler.
Okay, there's always that chance.
I'm just saying
there's some problems in profit, the profit motive for research. That's a good motivator.
Well, we're not talking about research here. We're talking about primary care. We're talking about how do you deliver health care to people. And every other country in the world says, you know, we'll pay doctors well. We'll compensate them for that 8 years in medical school. They're going to be at the top end of the middle class. They're going to do very well. They're going to be comfortable. They'll be able to put their kids through school. They'll have a good retirement. They'll have a good pension. You know, they'll have a good life. And we want people who care about healing people coming into this, not just people who care about getting rich, because people who just care about getting rich are going to corrupt the system. Steve, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Interesting point of view. John in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, John.
Yes. I'm retired. I worked in the insurance industry all my life. There's a very simple thing that a lot of these people seem to be overlooking. That is, why does a corporation exist in America? It exists for one purpose, and that is to maximize profit.
Right.
That is the goal, to maximize profit.
Right, and the secondary purpose is to produce a good or service. Yeah.
Exactly. So whenever you're talking about something like, say, health insurance, an insurance company is essentially almost acting like a bank or a transfer agent. You're just transferring money from an employer who's bought a policy, an individual, to the provider. They're going to try to maximize the amount that's, I think earlier you referred to overhead. Of course, they're going to try to maximize the amount that they make. There's no particular incentive for the government to maximize the overhead.
No, in fact, the government's incentive is to provide health care because that's their only purpose, is to serve the people.
Exactly. And with health insurance, what I don't know, seems to be missed by a lot of people, is you're essentially transferring funds. You're transferring funds for a service. Well, the most inefficient way to do that is through a corporation.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, John, and thank you very much for the call. And the folks who say, hey, do you really want the same people to run the post office to be providing your health care? My response to that would be, do you really want General Electric to be deciding if you go to prison or not, or if you get the death penalty? I mean, government actually does some things fairly well, running our court system by and large. I think the post office is actually quite well run. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Curry supplies are limited.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year.
You tell him, Jackson Brown.
In the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, a shadow on the faces of the men where their business interests run. Welcome back. You are smack dab in the middle of a vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friend. Steve in Toronto, Ontario, on the line. Hey, Steve, we're getting a lot of Canadians today. I guess we've touched a nerve.
Well, it's not really touching a nerve. It's just you hear a lie and you want to speak out, right? And basically, it's just not an issue in Canada. Healthcare is just not an issue. We don't.
In other words, it works just fine.
Pardon?
It works just fine for you.
Pardon?
The Canadian healthcare system is working just fine for you, Steve.
It's absolutely working fine, and you know what? If the post office wants to run it, that's fine too, because the U.S. post works fine, and the Canada post works fine too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my take on it. So you haven't experienced long waiting lines. You're able to see a doctor whenever you want. If you get sick, you can show up at the hospital. They take care of you. You don't have to wait in, you know, outside for 3 weeks because you just broke your leg. All these horror stories that the conservatives are telling us here in the United States are lies.
Not only that, okay, but I don't even have to see the same doctor. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how it works in the U.S., but wherever it says doctor, I could just walk in and see the doctor. If I need a hospital, any hospital is fine.
You mean you don't even need to make an appointment?
No appointment, no nothing.
You just walk in, say, I'm here, I need
to
see a doctor?
Bring my health card.
All you have to do is bring your health card.
That's it.
That's amazing. Steve, thank you very much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Matt in Wichita, Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Tom, just a quick comment for the guy that called you earlier.
Sure.
I can give you a couple of examples here. My cousin graduated valedictorian of his medical school class, could have gone into any medical field he wanted to. He chose to be a general practitioner because that's what he loves. My girlfriend, on the other hand, has a master's degree, is working on her doctorate, teaches high school English for $40,000 a year because that's what she loves doing. The idea that good quality people are motivated only by money, like your earlier caller suggested, is preposterous.
It's a sick idea, really. And that idea, which is promulgated by the Bushies and the conservatives, is, in my opinion, a psychological cancer in our society.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. I just couldn't be quiet on that one.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, man. Thanks for speaking up and saying it out loud. It's good on you for doing it. You know, Ronald Reagan, I remember when Ronald Reagan gave a speech once, and he made a little joke. This must have been around 1983, as I recall. He said, there may be a few good people in government, but by and large, none of them are left. He said, anybody in government who is any good would have gotten a job with private industry for more pay. And I remember hearing him say that and thinking, and it got a huge laugh from the audience. And I remember hearing him thinking that and thinking to myself, this guy doesn't understand public service. This guy doesn't understand governance. And this guy doesn't understand humanity, just, you know, fundamental humanity. Kim in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Kim, welcome to the program.
Yeah, actually, I'm from Montana.
But, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
Las Vegas, Montana?
Las Vegas. Yeah, I wanted to talk. I spent 10 years in Singapore at the University of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
And they have what I would think is the best healthcare system in the world.
Right.
And the way they do it is that if you are talented, they will send you to school for as many years as it takes. I have a friend that was a PhD in philosophy, got it from Oxford, and he had like 9 years of being called bonded. And what they do is they bring you back to the country and they tell you where you should work. And it's not like
to pay it back, sort of. To pay back your education, you mean?
Yeah, and so basically they'll tell you where to work, but they don't put you in bad places because they put a great investment into you.
Sure.
And so at any point you can buy out your bond, like a dentist friend of mine who was an oral surgeon. She bought it out, went to the bank and said, I can make this much money working on the foreigner's teeth and buy it out.
That's
and
interesting.
as an example of how it turns out is I was there fairly recently, and my daughter had an earache on a Sunday. We did that recently in Montana, and it cost us $400 for the emergency room.
Right. Yeah.
We walked a block and a half to a little doctor's office we'd never been to before. It took us a total of 5 minutes to go and see the doctor and fill out the paper because we'd never been there before and get the medicine.
Yeah.
And it cost $12.
Yeah. There you go. Well said,
yeah.
Kim. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. John in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Listen, you know, I've always been intrigued by your promulgation of the concept of the commons. And I think, you know, in order...
It's the concept on which this country was founded. It's
absolutely
why it's called the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That was the core concept of this country.
But we have to be more pragmatic in selling it to these so-called conservatives in that, you know, you always get the argument back that, well, that's just knee-jerk bleeding heart liberalism. But I think the founders understood, and I think during the Depression, the lesson was taught to us again, that when we have a permanent underclass without a social safety net, it is a liability to the entire society.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the most important points that you can make, John. I lived and worked in India for a while, where you walk out the door and you are surrounded by little kids with diseases all over them and lice and everything, with their hands out begging. And is that the kind of society that we want in the United States? I mean, that was, when I was there back a decade ago, that was the free market economy. Right. And I saw the same thing in Colombia. I saw the same thing in Uganda. I saw the same thing in Peru. All over the world, in Southeast Asia, in countries where there is very little social safety net, that's what you see. And, you know, it hurts the quality of life of all of us. Very simply, the quality of life of all of us. 57 minutes past the hour, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. It's the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you think you know what you didn't know, sometimes you don't even know what you need to know that you didn't know that you needed to know, and sometimes, of course, everything you know is wrong.
Know that you're wrong. But you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Is everything you know about the avian flu, the bird flu, wrong? We'll find out. We have with us Dr. I just lost my page here. Dr. Gil Smolin, he's a clinical professor and researcher with a special interest in infectious diseases at the University of California Medical School. Dr. Smolin, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Glad
I didn't lose my page, so I know who I am.
Yeah, there you go. I'm trying to a little multitasking here. Actually, somebody in the chat room popped up a private window in front of me, and it just boing off goes my screen. The avian flu, the bird flu. First of all, misconception number one. There are people out there who are saying, oh, I don't have to worry about this. Only 100 or so people have gotten it. And even though more than half of them have died, it doesn't seem to be spreading around the world. There's nothing to worry about, right? The bottom line is that we really don't have a bird flu problem yet with regard to humans because we don't have a human-to-human transmissible form. It hasn't mutated yet into that. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. But there are several caveats to that. One is that this particular virus, like all other influenza viruses, or a certain type of virus is called an RNA virus, and it has the ability to change or mutate slightly, very rapidly, and so that it's continually changing and evolving. And at some point, it's suspected that it may evolve to a form that will be able to be transmitted from human to human. And when that happens, someone getting in a plane in Asia without any symptoms whatsoever can fly to the United States and the virus is here.
Yeah, in fact, two things. One, the big concern, it seems, is that somebody would get would be infected with the bird flu in the non-human to human contagious form, and they would also be infected with a contagious human flu, and those two flu viruses could exchange some genes, and boom, you've now got a human to human contagious bird flu. And number two, that the period when people are most contagious, when they're infected with a viral disease, is not when they're symptomatic, it's before they're symptomatic. Are those both correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And it's sort of, to simplify it for your listeners, I would say, maybe it doesn't have to be simplified, but basically what happens is the bird flu has certain characteristics, and it affects animals. It can affect pigs. It can affect humans. Not a great number, but it can. And it has certain characteristics. And then the human flu has certain characteristics. Just as you mentioned, if some animal gets both flus at the same time, they can reassort, is the term, or they can exchange characteristics, and basically thinking of sort of like their offspring will have some of the characteristics of the bird flu and some of the characteristics of the human flu. And the bird flu is deadly, and the human flu is transmitted from human to human.
It's contagious.
Rapidly.
Yeah, so then you've got a deadly contagious flu, and
exactly.
Right now this is a flu that has a morbidity rate 60-70%. I mean, that's truly scary. A couple of very straightforward questions here. First of all, again, I don't know if it's a myth or if there's some reality to it out there, is that if you get a shot for the flu, or if for that matter you are exposed to the flu, just normal average garden variety flu, you're exposed to the flu, you come down with flu symptoms, that you will therefore, as a result of either having had the vaccination, which stirs up your immune system against that particular flu virus, or having been infected by a flu virus, not the bird flu, you will have a greater immunity to bird flu if this thing breaks out into pandemic status. Is there any reality to that?
No. In
okay.
fact, just about nobody has resistance to this particular new variant of flu.
Okay. And the second question, Tamiflu. Actually, there's four different antiviral drugs that are being kicked around out there. Tamiflu is probably the most well-known. It's made by Roche, a company out of Switzerland. I understand they've just licensed another factory to manufacture it because the demand is so great. Tamiflu, if you read the literature, from the manufacturer, I have, and they suggest that if you take it at the onset of symptoms, it will reduce the time of symptoms by, on average, 1.3 to 1.5 days. Is that reduction of symptoms by a day and a half going to be enough to save people's lives?
Well, I don't think it's a reduction in the length of time, but the severity.
The severity, okay.
Yes, and I think Tamiflu has been demonstrated to decrease the severity of other types of influenza infections. I should mention that of the four antivirals available, two of them do not work against this. Amantadine and Remantadine do not work against the bird flu. And the company making Relenza, which is the third, is very small, and they can't produce a sufficient amount. So we're basically left with Tamiflu.
Right. And the Tamiflu manufacturer, from what I'm reading in the Wall Street Journal, just in the business pages, the Tamiflu manufacturer has so many orders from the countries of Switzerland, where it's manufactured, the country of France, the country of England, Germany. We never got around to ordering it, that they are like a couple of years behind in terms of their production, and the Bush administration never bothered to order. Well, actually, they ordered some 300,000 doses, apparently, for all the bigwigs in Washington, D.C., but for the rest of us, they never bothered to order any.
We presently have about 1% of the Tamiflu that we need to cover the people in the United States.
Now, what about these online pharmacies that say that, if you pay $70 and you talk to an online doctor, and then they'll sell you the Tamiflu for $50 on top of that, so for $125 you can get an online Tamiflu prescription. Are you actually getting Tamiflu, or are they selling phony drugs?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I would say that probably, just logically, sometimes you're getting Tamiflu, but there's also a possibility you're not. So I would say caveat emptor.
So should people see their doctor and try and get a prescription for this now, or is it, do pharmacies stock Tamiflu?
I don't actually think it's unwise for people to do that, to stock up on getting some Tamiflu at the moment. Obviously,
so it might be a good idea.
Around.
It might be a good idea to get it while it's still available.
Yes, and as far as a vaccine is concerned, this year's vaccine obviously doesn't cover the flu shot, doesn't cover the bird flu. And as far as developing a vaccine for bird flu, nothing's been developed to date, but I'm fairly certain that within a very short period of time there will be a vaccine against the bird flu. But there's problems with that, again, not having enough, and two, since the influenza virus changes, the vaccine that's produced today may not be effective in 4 to 6 months.
And I understand the third problem is that while most influenzas are carried by birds, or many of them, and they can even sometimes make birds sick, this particular flu is like Ebola to birds. Birds just melt down. It kills them off. And because our flu vaccines are incubated in bird eggs, in chicken eggs, the flu itself, this H5N1 variant, is killing the eggs, and they haven't figured out a way to grow the thing.
Right. That is a problem. I should say that the fact that it kills off the birds is in some way good news, not for the birds.
It'll be self-limiting.
Yes, it makes it self-limiting. The bad news is that ducks and other animals harbor the virus without showing symptoms and without dying. So there's a reservoir of virus that's sitting out there in the animal population.
In that case, should people who live in close proximity to ducks and geese be concerned? For example, I live in a floating house on a river, and I got geese sitting on my backyard. Do I need to stay away from them?
I would say not in the United States, but certainly in Asia, people should avoid intimate contact if they can. I mean, it's very difficult with.
Well, I don't kiss them, but you know, I.
Right.
But they are, you know, they poop on the deck and stuff, and you know, it's a. So,
well, you know, it's in the aerosol, so it's in the air. They breathe it, so the virus is in the air, and also in the fecal material as well, as you indicated.
Right. So if the bird flu comes to the United States, then people would be well advised to stay away from birds.
Absolutely.
Interesting. And
you know, it was fascinating. About 3 years ago, I started to write a novel, and I finished it. It's called Reign of the Rat. And it was a situation in which we have a resistant organism arising in Asia and then spreading and causing a deadly pandemic. And then I had to think of ways of preventing it from killing people. And actually, the avian flu is mirroring exactly what I wrote about, unfortunately. And because I wrote about it because I knew this type of thing does happen with regularity. The avian flu has, we had the Asian flu in 1968, the Hong Kong flu in 57, the deadly Spanish flu in 1918. So this occurs with some regularity.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Gil Smolin, a clinical professor and researcher at the University of California Medical School. Dr. Smolin, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And for giving us the straight scoop on this. This is going to be a really tough one for us if this thing mutates, and it looks like more like it's going to be a when than an if. Again, Dr. Smolin, thank you. It is 16 and one-half minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You've got a headache, and I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Pretenitorivox.
Yeah, right. Preventive Jarvis.
It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
Uh-oh.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucination.
Welcome back, friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. But it's great stuff, isn't it? And you see these pharmaceutical companies out there advertising this stuff all the time. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. What is our government doing about the bird flu? Well, Bush thinks he can fight it with the Army. He thinks he can fight everything with the Army. And this is not, by the way, some surprise. As Dr. Gil Smolin, who was just with us, clinical professor and researcher at the University of California Medical School, pointed out, we've had three bird flu epidemics in the last 40 years. None have been H5N1 variants. That's the last time we saw that was in 1918. But this, we've known about this for 2 years now. And Bush has done, well, pretty much as he did before 9/11 when he had those 56 warnings saying that they were going to hijack airplanes and they were looking at high-profile buildings in New York City and Washington, D.C. Nothing. Well, actually, I don't know if he's asked the military to stand down yet or not, or if they've busted any FBI agents who are looking at suspicious-looking ducks. I don't know. We'll find out. Victoria Jones is with us with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Now, I watch the Discovery Channel, which is probably just as well, because I'm able to recognize a feeding frenzy when I see it, because I just participated in one at the White House press briefing.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You've got, look, this is C-SPAN.
Blood in the water, huh?
Blood in the water, because Scott started to lose his temper.
Oh, my. Is this because of the new revelations that Harriet Myers said that she wouldn't join the Federalist Society because it was politically oriented?
Well, that came up, but it wasn't that that seemed to set him off. I think it was partly being raked over the coals yesterday. He's still very sensitive about that. But he basically started making remarks to journalists about what their motives were in asking certain questions and about their reporting. He went after John Roberts in the most astonishing way.
Wait a minute. John Roberts, the Supreme Court Justice?
John Roberts, the CBS reporter.
Oh, okay. And
then went after everybody, basically. And when people it was to do with Harriet Myers and the discussion of religion yesterday.
Right.
And he was basically saying that the press had made this an issue, to which everyone replied, the president spoke about it, you brought it up, you talked about it, we're just reporting it. And this was a huge back and forth. And then he said he was interested, he wanted this discussion, but he only wanted to answer questions about Harriet Myers' philosophy and judicial philosophy and restraint and all this kind of stuff. So I'm desperate. I'd already asked my question. I have my hand up and I'm shouting, I have a question about judicial philosophy. I have a question about judicial philosophy.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get to ask it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He left.
But you do from time to time, and you do always marvelous ones.
Well, no, I did ask a question. I asked a previous question about mm-hmm. Harriet Myers. I wanted him to give me three examples of cases that she was involved in that were trailblazing.
And the answer was?
That wasn't what they meant by trailblazing.
Oh, what did they mean by trailblazing?
Well, that she was the first woman this and the first woman that. And the
oh, I thought they meant that she was out there with Bush, with George helping clear Bush, clear shrub. She actually did, you know. She went down to Crawford and went out with a chainsaw and helped him clear shrub one day.
She was apparently the only woman who goes on those trips.
Yeah, yeah. So,
that's,
you know, she's
it?
One of the boys. Yeah, well, yeah. It literally is trailblazing. The technical definition is marking a trail. You're blazing it. You're marking it. You know, you put little notches in trees so you can find your way back. But I suppose clearing brush qualifies, making a trail.
I think so.
So you think the White House has its back against the wall?
Oh, I think so. And it was interesting. I asked whether, in light of the fact that, you know, she served in the White House with the president. Now, did I ask this, or was this what I wanted to ask? No, I didn't get to ask. No, I asked something else, but I've forgotten what it was. Yes, it has its back against the wall. He was asked whether she has the tenacity to go through this or whether she might consider withdrawing. And that was really what set Scott off.
Yeah.
Didn't really answer that.
Here's the question I have, not for him, but for you, Victoria Jones.
Yes, sir.
And that is, the press was really not asking these kinds of hard questions about John Roberts. Nobody even raised the fact, for example, that he had been down in Florida, you know, banging on the windows saying stop the vote or coaching the lawyers. I mean, the conservatives all loved John Roberts, and the press seem to love John Roberts. The conservatives now are paranoid about Harriet Myers, and all of a sudden the press is getting paranoid about Harriet Myers. Is this a symptom of the press doing the bidding of the conservatives?
I think it's a symptom of the press doing the bidding of the people who they think are making the news, and in this case it is conservatives. I think if it had been Priscilla Owen and if Ted Kennedy and the left were up in arms, they would be asking questions like this also. But I think because this is more like man biting dog, because nobody expected the conservatives to be up on their hind legs, they feel that makes even more of a story.
Yeah. It seems to me that the so-called liberal media seems to be, you know, when the conservatives loved John Roberts, the so-called liberal media loved John Roberts. When the conservatives are paranoid about Harriet Myers, all of a sudden the so-called liberal media is paranoid about Harriet Myers. And it just doesn't add up in my brain. I'm sorry. But
maybe onto something then.
Yeah, but I'm glad you're there and asking the tough questions because you do such a great job. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria, for checking in with us today. We'll talk with you soon. It's 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM. Back with your calls right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Call me a chicken hawk, proud to be a chicken hawk, a loyal armchair jock. Let's check that Lockheed stock. I didn't walk the walk, but I can talk the talk.
It's the official Dick Cheney song. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. Should health care be a right of all? What should George W. Bush have been doing and the Bush administration have been doing over the last 2 years that they've known about the bird flu to protect the United States? Is there going to be blowback to them if millions of people in this country die from the bird flu the way that they died in New Orleans? And, you know, will the Republicans survive? Because basically the Republicans, the cons have been saying, oh, well, it's a free market solution. Just let the wealthy people get their Tamiflu. You'll recall, those of you who are longtime listeners of this program, you will recall 6, 8, 9 months ago, it must have been longer than that, because we moved from Vermont to Oregon in either March or April. I think we moved out here in March, and it was before we moved. So it must have been January or February of this year. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, because I remember doing the show from Vermont about this, an article in the Wall Street Journal about Tamiflu. And it was basically saying, it was kind of one of these wink, wink, nod, nod articles. You know, the Wall Street Journal being some of the best reporting in the country, really good, high-quality reporting. Their editorial page makes me cringe, but they have some very good reporters. And they were talking about the bird flu story, and they were talking about Tamiflu, and they did this very in-depth story about how little Tamiflu there was on the planet and how restricted the supplies were going to be and how wealthy people who were in the know were seeing their doctors and getting their prescriptions filled right away so they'd be ready if this bird flu jumped the species barrier just in case. Because wealthy people could afford to get their prescription filled and see their doctor. And I thought, that's interesting. And I shared it on the air, and I've talked about it several times since then. So, you know, it's like, what should the Bush administration have been doing? Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, and Rebecca in Foxborough, Vermont on the line. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I called because your guest from the RAND Institute mentioned in passing health savings accounts as a good free market alternative.
Yes. Why don't you just save a little money every month, and when you get some horrible disease that costs $1 million to repair, you'll have it, won't you?
Actually, I'm the owner of a small business, and we have 5 employees, 3 of whom are family members, and 2 of whom aren't. And we just got insurance, and one of the options we took was HSA.
Mm-hmm.
And I have discovered that it's a nasty little, I think, in my opinion, we're going to discontinue using it because I've discovered as the employer I have no responsibility. I don't have to pay any penalties if I screw anything up on their deposits, although I'm responsible for making their deposits because they're pre-tax, at least as near as we can figure out by this well-run free market bill or plan. Anyway, the bottom line is there are a lot of penalties involved, and they all seem to accrue to the employee's health savings account.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of catch-22 rules involved as well.
And if any of these penalties are violated or if any of these rules are broken, I'm assuming that probably the brokerage firm makes a little extra profit and
the
a little extra fee?
The bank makes some money on it, it looks like. As near as we can tell, because trying to get information about it from the various companies that are making money on this health savings account is like trying to find a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
So when he talks about that, I would love it someday if one of those guys does bring it up again. If you would pin them down and ask them to explain health savings accounts.
Okay. Okay. We'll take a shot at that sometime.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening, Rebecca, and thanks for sharing that with us. It's interesting. That's my first experience with HSAs. HSAs, health savings accounts. I don't have one, And I just know the whole idea seems creepy to me that if I put $50 away every month, that somehow I'll be able to deal with a broken leg or God forbid, cancer or something. I mean, it just seems crazy. Phil in Tampa, Florida on the line. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Good morning or afternoon.
All of the above. Hey, Phil.
I want to preface my remarks by saying doctors make about 25% of what Rush Limbaugh makes. And Rush Limbaugh...
Oh, they make a lot less than that. I mean, okay. I think he sold his business for, what, was it $140 million?
Right. And most doctors are, especially the newer ones, they're saddled with $125,000, $150,000 worth of debt from their school.
Right.
But I sold surgeon preference products to physicians in California for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to develop relationships with them. And when I did, got to know them personally, the thing that they're interested in talking about primarily is how they weren't making enough money.
Sure. Well, if you have a for-profit medical system that rewards people who get into it because they want to make money, then you're going to have people in it mostly who just want to make money. But I can tell you from the time that I lived in Germany and my experience with the British healthcare system that those physicians that I interacted with and my family interacted with, they were in it because they loved medicine.
Right. But I can tell you that that's all they wanted to talk about. They weren't the reimbursement from Medicare because they want, you know, whatever, you know, the issue was, well, what's the CPT code and what are they paying now? They're not paying enough. They were to pay this and they used to pay that.
Yeah.
But remember, you know, and yeah, they are money motivated, but remember, these people save people's vision, their sight, their life, etc. And for them, with all the education and the debt for the education, for them to be making 10% of you know what Rush Limbaugh makes is a horrible distortion in the marketplace.
Yeah, although I wouldn't hold Limbaugh up as a standard by which anything should be judged. I mean, it's kind of an aberration.
Well, look at Sean Hannity. I can tell you, he's a millionaire.
Yeah,
Riley's a millionaire.
Sure. Sure, and but most I'll bet you most of the money that those guys are making is through TV, not radio, because the big bucks are not in radio. Frankly, it's but in any case, it's yeah. We have a celebrity culture in the United States, and
right.
I don't think that that's a particularly healthy thing either. But that's a whole nother discussion. But the point that you raise and where I agree with you on that, and I think it's a symptom of the sickness of our society, is that tragically because. One of the sure paths to riches, particularly in some fields like oncology, for example, or plastic surgery, is to become a doctor. You have people who become doctors because they want the money. On the other hand, there are a lot of fields like general practice where doctors don't make that much money. And you get some really, really good people who are GPs or family physicians or pediatricians, and they're in it because they really care about the medicine and they really care about their patient. Obgyns. I mean, there's some of these specialties that just, you know, are not spectacularly well
right.
paid and where they have to just work their butts off. I mean, they have to literally dedicate their lives to these things, to these professions, to these subspecialties or these specialties. And there's some very, very fine people out there in that. And so if we had a healthcare system that guaranteed that physicians could, excuse me on that, that guaranteed that physicians could always make a decent living and yet at the same time, didn't provide opportunities for those people who want to get rich to, say, get rich by going into medicine, you would filter out. Because, frankly, I just don't want a doctor working on me who's more concerned with how much he can make from me than he is on whether or not I'm going to get well. I don't want a guy working on me or a woman working on me who's thinking, well, okay, if I do this, this, and this, I'll make $20,000, whereas if I do this or this, I'll only make $3,000, and the $3,000 thing might actually be better for me. Or it might be less invasive, or it might be less painful, and unfortunately, we have a system that's the other way around.
But the other part that you're not mentioning is when they track hospitals have been tracked that do the great number of bypasses.
Right.
Okay. Where it's, you know, the reimbursement is obviously much greater.
Yeah.
And they see that, and they can figure out that it's really financially oriented. There's no negative consequence to the doctors or the hospital for that. Other than being exposed to whoever happens to hear the news report.
Yeah, absolutely. So that study, that was 5-6 years ago, wasn't it, when they first came out with that study where they found that a lot of unnecessary bypasses were being done because reimbursement was available and hospitals were turning them into profit centers. Amazing stuff. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Freeman in San Diego, California. Hey, Freeman. You got to be listening to the phone, not the radio. So we will move to Ed in San Juan, California. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Just for the heck of it, you know, I think I'm about joining the Ian Rand Association. I think we have too many poor people.
Okay.
We've got 1%, and oddly enough, that 1% of the vaccines will go to the, how many rich people do we have in this country?
Well, it depends on how you define rich. If you're talking a net worth that's over about $10 million, I think it's around 14,000 people.
Yeah, well, we got enough for them, don't we?
Yeah.
What's the matter, Tom? You're not in that?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
I'm not even close.
Well, that's once again, too bad, too short.
Yeah, no, I'm doing this because I care about my country.
When are we going to realize that by calling out the troops, when are we going to start talking about this quarantine thing that he wants to quarantine the cities and stuff? How's that going to work? I can hardly wait to see.
It's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. I mean, they couldn't quarantine the Black Plague. With SARS, it worked, but they didn't have to have the military to do it. It was an entirely civilian operation. In fact, it was a largely medical operation. It was isolation and quarantine, not there's going to be a gun in your face if you come into this city kind of thing.
Keep me in my house?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that
Walmart.
Well, the bottom line here is that the Bush administration, these Bushies and Gonzalez and company, they really just don't have much use for the first 10 articles of the Bill of Rights, of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, otherwise known as the Bill of Rights. And the whole idea that people can speak up. No, you go to a free speech zone. The whole idea that people should, you know, be able to defend themselves. The whole idea that people should have freedom of motion, that they should have privacy rights, all of that stuff. And suspending constitutional rights? Hey, here's a great opportunity. Here's a great excuse. Ed, thanks for the call.
Have a great day, Tom.
You too. Yeah, it's just, in my mind, one more excuse for them to blow away democracy a little farther in this country. And we can't let them do it. We just can't let them do it. We've got to stand up and say, no, we love this country. We're going to keep it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear.
And welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Jerry in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I had two occasions that I needed to use healthcare overseas. And while I wouldn't trade necessarily our monarchy for theirs, and I was in Morocco, and I had an acute asthma attack, and whereas here I would have had to go through a lot of stuff to get treated, emergency room and all that, I walked into the nearest pharmacy, and they gave me the medicine I needed over the counter without a prescription, whereas mm-hmm. I would have had a prescription here. And then I thought that was
great. I had that experience in India where I had a really bad intestinal thing, and I walked into a pharmacy, and they gave me an antibiotic over the counter.
Yeah, and then we were in Greece, and my wife got bit by an insect that her hand swelled up like a balloon, and she was feverish and bedridden for a little bit. And I walked into the local pharmacy, and explained the situation, and the guy diagnosed it right there, gave me the medicine I needed, didn't cost me anything.
Yeah.
And I went back, and it was handled. And it was kind of like just a slap in the face, you know, about our profit-driven system versus a humanity-driven system, you know.
Yeah, we have the most dysfunctional healthcare system in the world. We have an infant mortality rate that's worse than Cuba.
Yeah.
We have roughly 50 million people in America who have no health insurance, which doesn't mean that they have no access to health care. What it means is that when, you know, somebody shows up with their kid having an asthma attack in a hospital emergency room, which is really their only venue for getting care, it costs all of us $600 rather than the $15 it would have cost if that kid had, you know, access to a regular doctor and could just walk in and you know, make the copay and squirt the medic.
It's just unfortunate that people, because we're controlled by this propagandized media, that we don't, until we have these anecdotal situations where people actually, like me and my wife, had to experience this overseas, really don't understand that like the people who are calling from Canada who say, hey, wait a minute, you guys are getting the wrong information here, you know, that how bad things really are for us here. And I think we just, you know, I thank you for bringing it up and talking about it.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for the call, Jerry. And I want to thank our Canadian listeners for calling in and pointing this out. It's great. Sometimes these topics, we'll have people call in from Australia or Norway or Canada or whatever. It's some of the web listeners or folks listening on Sirius Satellite. Paul in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I think that the average physician probably makes about 1/100th of what Rush Limbaugh makes.
Yeah, as I said, I don't think he's a benchmark for anything. But
no.
But I have been saying for a long, long time that when we start paying our teachers and our cops the same that we're paying, you know, regular mid-level executives, that we'll see a vast improvement in our society. I mean, we just need to reorder our priorities,
yeah.
Frankly.
Just a couple of comments. I actually called about the avian flu situation. I wanted to make some comments on that, but I was interested in one of your other callers and what he was talking about. The average debt of most of my medical students is about $200,000 to $250,000. So they're about $250,000 in debt by the time they finish school.
Do you teach medicine, Paul?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
Now, one of the things that I think is very important, you bring this up, and it's a great subject to talk about, but, you know, a single-payer healthcare system, I think, eventually is the answer. But the question is when. And, you know, are we going to really let the current leaders, of our government actually, take our health care and, you know, are we going to trust them to give us a good single health care?
Well, this was my problem with Clinton's program, with the one that Hillary Clinton had, because it was an incremental, you know, let's step into this backwards. Let's bring the health insurance companies with us. And it's like saying, you know, let's treat this cancer by cutting out a third of it. And I just, you know, I think that we have two models. There are two basic worldwide. There's basically two models for healthcare. There's essentially socialized medicine, which they have in England more or less, which is where the government actually owns the clinics and the doctors are employees of the government. And then there's single payer healthcare system like they had in Germany when I lived there, where the government is, you know, basically the insurance company. The government writes the checks, but the doctors are independent, the hospitals are independent, and like that. And the example, the model we have in the United States of socialized medicine is the Veterans Administration, which when it's funded appropriately works very, very well. And the model we have for single payer health care is the Medicare system, which works very, very well. As I said, you know, less than 3% overhead and they never miss a check and they actually pay. And so I think that we should simply say Medicare, I prefer single payer over socialized medicine. I think we should simply say everybody in America is covered by Medicare starting tomorrow morning.
That's the answer. The question is how we're going to fund it. And the other thing that...
Well, you'd fund it with a tax increase, but the average American right now who has health insurance is paying $10,680 a year for it, either themselves or through their employers. And if you gave everybody insurance and you had an income tax increase, it would cost less than $3,500 per person. So most of us would see a reduction in our overall expenses. Even though our taxes go up, our health insurance costs are going down.
I completely agree with you, and if we lived in a perfect world, that would be the answer. The thing is, I just don't trust the current administration to be able to do anything correctly.
Oh, neither do I. That's why we need to change the administration.
The other thing I would also mention, too, is that there is actually more than two forms of a single-payer system. There's also the Medicaid system.
Yes.
The Medicaid system is a horrible failure in Illinois, and a lot of doctors are afraid of it for obvious reasons. I mean, the reimbursement is absolutely terrible.
The problem with Medicaid, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I mean, you probably know more about it than I do, but my sense of the problem with Medicaid is that it's part federal funded, part state funded, and therefore both, since you've got two entities that are having to come up, you know, ante up the bill, each is trying to offload the expense to the other all the time.
Absolutely. You know, I just wanted to make another comment, but I think I'm running out of time. I wanted to talk about DNA viruses, a DNA vaccine, and the avian flu, and there's actually a lot of promising studies on that.
Okay, well, give us a call back a little later in the week, and we can talk about it. Thanks a lot, Paul. Paul, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, and, you know, even occasionally Hamilton and Washington and Adams. But not the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute or any of these other right-wing think tanks.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, to win an election, anyway. We'll start there. Welcome back to our program, broadcast live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet at RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. Welcome back to the program. How do we get out of Iraq? What's the situation? What's the exit strategy? I think we have done to death the failures of the Bush administration in getting us into Iraq, and not just the failures, the lies, all of it. And certainly there's a time and place to rant about that. This isn't it right now, I don't think. I'm concerned about some solutions. And for those, I wanted to go to one of the smartest people on earth about this kind of stuff, Lawrence Korb. Larry Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, AmericanProgress.org, of course, the website for the Center for American Progress. Lawrence Korb, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you again.
Glad to have you back. The Bush administration has presented us with these two polar options. One is stay the course. In other words, just keep doing what we're doing and slowly try to build what appears to be an Iraqi army and put into place what may or may not be an Iraqi democracy of some sort, and slowly draw ourselves down to the 17 major bases we're building. Or on the other hand, to use their phrase, cut and run. Seems to me like there's a strong argument to be made for simply pulling back to the bases that we have built or have built, and letting the Iraqis sort this out. But then there's a lot of folks who say that's going to lead to a bloodbath and a civil war. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think you don't have any good choices now. I think you're quite right. We can't argue we shouldn't be there, but we are there, and we don't have good choices. So no matter what option you pick, people are going to say, well, it could do this or could do that. And my feeling is what you need to do is the following. After the election in December, either to elect a permanent government or to elect another government to rewrite the Constitution,
assuming that the Constitution gets ratified next week.
Well, I mean, if it doesn't, then you still have another election to pick a new government to write a new Constitution.
I see. Okay.
I do think that it will be ratified now. I mean, the accommodations that they made yesterday, I think, will get enough Sunnis to not vote against it so that you won't be able to get the two-thirds.
Those were substantial. Yeah.
Yeah, I still think you can have a majority of Sunnis against it, which is, the real problem. The real problem is not the Constitution. The real problem is it accepted by all of the, the groups in the country. But I think after the election, you say, okay, now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start withdrawing our troops. We're not going to have any permanent bases here, and we're going to start a withdrawal, and it's going to be done within 2 years. By the end of the year, we're going to be down to 60,000 troops. And as we withdraw, we expect you guys to take over more of the fighting. We'll keep on training you. And, at the end of 2 years, for all practical purposes, we're out of here. We can leave, Marines to guard the embassy like we do in other places. We will stay in the region, though. We're going to keep Marines over the horizon, or we can keep some Army troops in Kuwait, which we've had ever since the end of the first Persian Gulf War, in case the thing really gets out of hand, if the Iranians start marching in or something. And this will have a number of good effects. First of all, it will give the Iraqis an incentive to get their act together. Right now, they don't have to. We're there, so why should they worry about, dealing with all these threats? I mean, we end up not just fighting insurgents, we end up dealing with, for keeping Shiites from killing other Shiites.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing it would do, it will deflate part of the insurgency. the Bush administration keeps talking about all the foreign fighters. They're at most 10% of the insurgents. A lot of the insurgents simply don't believe we're going to leave. And that's why they're fighting. And so if we tell them we're leaving, no permanent bases, give them a timetable, that deflates part of the insurgency. And also will deflate some of the support for the insurgents. And, you know, people talk about, well, you know, the Iraqis need to be trained more. Look, we've been training them long enough. That's not the issue. The issue is motivation.
Yeah, the Iraqis were trained before we got there. They had quite a competent army.
Right, but it's motivation. And,
You
know, are they prepared to defend their own country? You know, we take a young man or young woman, send them 3 months training, then send them to war.
Right.
You know, so this idea that they need to be trained and all that kind of stuff, it's motivation. Who's training the insurgents? They're doing pretty well. They're adapting and, you know, figuring out what to do. So I think that's, you know, that would be the best way to give you the best chance of getting out of there, having it turn into a stable country, and also dealing with our own problems. I mean, we're about to break our army. And, you know, if we break our army means we don't have a very effective army.
What do you mean by break our army?
Well, basically what's happened is that the army last year, the total army, active guard and reserve, was 25,000 short of the people they needed. That's 8 brigades. And they've also lowered the quality standards for the people coming in, which means that you're not going to have as high caliber people in terms of, you know, educational background and, you know, aptitude scores. In the reenlistments, they're meeting their targets among, if you will, the career people, but not among the first-term people. So, yes, you're getting a lot of people to stay in, but they're kind of the older people. So you're not getting them coming in, then you're going to have another gap. So your army's not going to be nearly as effective. If you don't get your guard people back soon, nobody's going to be, you know, getting up to speed on homeland security. And the wheels are going to come off the guard, because if you keep a person on active duty more than 1 year out of every 5, and for most of them we're well past that, and if you stay in Iraq again next year, you're going to have to keep doing that. Those people aren't going to stay, you know.
They signed up to be weekend warriors.
Right, right. But I mean, they
and to help out their community in a disaster.
Right, but they understand. I think 1 year out of every 5. That's a metric we used to use when I was in government, and I think that's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do it more than that, they're not going to stay.
Larry Korb, Lawrence Korb, don't you think that to some extent it would be a reasonable and safe thing to say that Iran has already won this conflict?
Iran's going to be influential in the new Iraq because the Shiites are the majority.
Well, and they've already signed mutual cooperation pacts, military cooperation pacts. Iran is sending money in. You have, Sistani, probably the most powerful cleric in all of Iraq, is Iranian.
Right.
You have a piece in the Constitution that essentially creates a Supreme Court that will have Shiite mullahs on it who can veto legislation, which is exactly, almost a clone of the Iranian system of government. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would we have to worry about Iran marching in when it looks to me like they've pretty much already taken over the country?
Well, and here's the point. None of the countries in the area want to see an unstable Iraq because it become a threat to all of them. They don't want it to see become a haven for terrorists. And if we can, move away from this and, you know, get the people to stop supporting the insurgents or joining them, they're going to fight to keep the foreign fighters out. They're secularists. They don't want these radical jihadists, you know.
Who are secularists?
The Iraqis.
Yeah, many of them. But,
yeah,
but to,
the Sunnis.
But,
the Sunnis are, you know.
By and large, secularists, yeah. But to what extent do the other Sunni countries around there, for example, Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Syria is largely Shiite, I guess, but some of the majority Sunni countries in that region, to what extent are they flipped out about the fact that Iraq is essentially falling under the sphere of influence of Iran, and if we follow this course of, you know, doing a constitution, having democracy, having, you know, and you end up with Shia control, and you end up with a Supreme Court that can veto things because they violate Shia theology, that essentially now you have Shia influence in a region where Shia influence outside of Iran, essentially, and arguably Syria, has been suppressed for the better part of, 500, 600, 700 years?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, is Qatar flipped out about this?
Well, basically, I think it depends. We have influence, but the question is, are they going to spread that influence to their countries? I think that's the key issue. You're right. Iran is going to be influential in the new Iraq or the post-Saddam Iraq because the Shiites are the majority. In terms of, you know, what you were talking about, you know, the religious courts and everything like that, those are only in the Shia area. And it's according to the Constitution, they're not in the other, but the Shias have the right to, you know, the right to do that.
Okay, one more quick question. We're going to push back a break just a minute or two. I want to get an answer to this. I'm really curious. What would be the difference between saying we're going to be out of here in 2 years and saying we're going to be out of here in 2 months? And we're going to withdraw to our own bases. I mean, we'll be nearby if you need us, but we're going to be out of here in 2 months.
Well, I think, first of all, logistically, it'd be hard just to pack up and go that quick. I mean, that's the first thing. The other is it gives the Iraqis time to get their act together and gives them a reasonable amount of time.
Doesn't it also give them time to have a civil war?
Well, they already got a civil war in many cases right now. I think when people, you know,
but that's my concern about a long period of disengagement.
I think as we begin to disengage and it becomes clear to people we're really going, they will give less support to the insurgency, and the insurgency will, you know, some of the insurgents will basically lay down their arms and say, well, you know, we don't want to be killing our fellow Iraqis, it's the Americans we're worried about.
Well, that's my point. I guess the core of my question is, to what extent are we the irritant that's driving all this? And if we get that irritant out of the way very quickly, will it allow the situation to start healing itself more rapidly than if we stick around for another 2 years as, you know, the continual salt in the wound?
You don't know for sure, but I think once they're sure we're going, that's what you need.
Yeah.
And I think you do have, you know, not only a strategic but a moral responsibility, you know, I mean, to give them a reasonable chance to stop the bloodletting and the killing. But, you know, you're right. I mean, as I said, there are no good options. This seems to me to be a reasonable one that gives you the best chance of keeping the place from falling apart.
Yeah, well said. Lawrence Korb, thank you so much for being with
us
today, sir.
Anytime.
I do appreciate it. Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, the website www.americanprogress.org for more information. A brilliant piece that he wrote along with Brian Katulis, A Progressive Plan for Iraq and the Struggle Against Violent Extremists. Check it out at americanprogress.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 18 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 23 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. You're in the democracy zone. The no boring zone. Welcome back to our program. Former Vice President Al Gore said Wednesday, he had no intention of ever running for president again. This was in Stockholm, Sweden. But he said the United States would be a very different country had he won the 2000 election. Now, for a fact, I know that he did win the 2000 election. What he meant, you know, this is simply how it's being reported by the Associated Press. I'm sure that probably the way that he said it was, had he been installed president of the United States by the Supreme Court, or had the vote actually been counted in Florida or something like that. Anyhow, he went on to say, if he had been the president, we would not have invaded a country that didn't attack us, he said, referring to Iraq. We would not have taken money from the working families and given it to the most wealthy families. We would not be trying to control and intimidate the news media. We would not be routinely torturing people. We would be a very different country. And it just reminded me how much I miss Al Gore. I mean, I am frankly relieved in a way that Joe Lieberman is not our vice president, because Joe Lieberman's neoconservative credentials have now come out. And I think, frankly, Al Gore must have been unaware of that. It's the only thing I can come up with, because Al Gore, in my mind, is a man of great integrity and great insight. And Al Gore and John Edwards, Al Gore and Howard Dean, Howard Dean and John Edwards, Howard Dean and Al Gore, any combination of those three people running for president and vice president, any two of those three, in the year 2008, and I would move mountains. I mean, to the extent that I'm able, I would do anything I could to see one of them elected, because I think we actually do have some statesmen and women. I'd like to see Barbara Boxer elected president of the United States as well. I think Barbara Boxer is a woman who could easily be the first female president of the United States and make a brilliant president. Barbara Boxer, the senator from California. So time will tell. But anyhow, here's Al. This is back some time ago. This is actually February 8th, 2004. So this is a year and a half ago. Al Gore talking about his opinion of George W. Bush. This is from before the last election. Al Gore.
Because I think there were millions just like me who genuinely, in spite of whatever partisanship they may have felt prior to that time, genuinely felt like they wanted George W. Bush to lead all of us in America wisely and well. And the reason I'm recalling those feelings now is because those are the feelings that were betrayed by this president.
And people say he's wooden.
He betrayed this country.
He betrayed this country.
He played on our fears.
He played on our fears. Tell him, Al.
He took America. He took America on an ill-conceived foreign adventure, dangerous to our troops, an adventure that was preordained and planned before 9/11 ever took place.
Planned before 9/11 even took place. This is a guy who understands about the Project for a New American Century and what Scooter Libby and his buddies Jeb Bush and Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl were all about. He's read the documents.
So whether it's the economy, where he said he'd be a moderate, or social policy, where he said he'd be middle of the road, compassionate, or foreign policy and military policy, I will say to the president that it is not a minor matter to take the loyalty and deep patriotic feelings of the American people and trifle with them.
And that's what he did, and that's exactly what George Bush did. Well said, Al Gore. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. And Motor Silk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL, 1-866-LESS-FUEL. The Tom Hartman here program here with you. Viagra for your brain. Speaking of statesmen, just a moment ago, I was saying that I think that Al Gore, Howard Dean, John Edwards, I consider them statesmen. Barbara Boxer, is there a female gender stateswoman, I guess? Statesperson? I don't know. It's what's made it into the dictionary or not, but whatever it is, she is one as well. And I also want to tip my hat to the only Republican that I have voted for as an adult. And yes, I actually in the 2002 election, I voted for a Republican. And it was Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont. And shortly after I voted for him, he decided he wasn't a Republican anymore because he said his party had moved away from him. He could no longer respect his own party. And he was being interviewed on Vermont Public Radio about his thoughts about George W. Bush and the war. And here is now a guy who his entire life had been a Republican. I mean, he'd been a Republican literally since he was a child. Here he is now in his, I think he's in his early 70s, late 60s, and been a Republican in public service throughout his life. And he's looking at the Republican president and his comments. First, the question from Steve Zinn of Vermont Public Radio, and then Jim Jeffords' response.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against what invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil. I think that that's the end result is going to be some oil agreement. And to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was, to me, just a re-election move. And they're going to try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised next year, probably in Iran.
Do you think that's likely?
Oh, I probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but do it each time they when I have a new president. I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
Jim Jeffords, the Republican senator from Vermont, back just after he ceased being the Republican senator from Vermont and is now the independent senator from Vermont. And as I said, the only Republican I've ever voted for. And just making these remarkable statements. They just did it for the oil. They just did it for the political power. They just did it to get reelected. Every time the Bush family wants one of their sons to become president, they declare a war. You know, what are they getting ready for Jeb? Is he going to be next? Amazing. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-TOM, THOM. And Freeman in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Freeman, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know, I listen to the show on delay, and I usually forward through the commercials, but somehow I seem to have a bunch of Eco Wine in my closet, and I have a motorcycle in my car. So I'm not
okay. Good on you.
So you say, isn't health care a human right, a basic human right?
Yes.
And I think that might be easy for some conservatives to say, no, you should, you know, that should be on your own. Instead of framing it that way, I would suggest framing it saying, you know, doesn't it benefit all of us to have people being healthy, just as doesn't it benefit all of us to have a, you know, educated workforce?
Yeah, you're taking the practical approach to it. I'm taking the philosophical approach to it, and
yeah.
And I'll grant you that yours would probably sell better, and probably in a practical context has more juice to it. Because the reality is, if you look at those countries where they have universal health care, you have a healthier workforce, you have a more productive workforce, you have people living longer, you have people living happier, you have less mental illness, you have less panic and fear of, you know, if I lose my job, will I lose my health care, and what happens if I get sick, blah, 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 blah. There's a whole lot of societal benefits that are very, very real. And just asking the rhetorical question, is health care a human right, doesn't highlight those. You're right. Good one, Freeman. Thank you.
People just don't work so well when they're dead.
Yeah, or when they're sick, for that matter. Yeah, good one. Okay, thank you. I will use that more often. I appreciate the feedback. 1-866-440-TOM, THOM. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, you remember Pat Tillman, the ex NFL football player that went over to Afghanistan?
I remember him well. It's just now coming out, you know, that he was he had an appointment with Howard Zinn when he got back, and he was going to come back to the United States and speak out against the war in Iraq just before he was killed.
So you've seen some of the same stuff I saw. Yeah, well, and more about Pat Tillman. Of course, Noam Chomsky was one of his favorite authors. He hated
yep.
George Bush, and he thought the war in Iraq was illegal. Now, isn't it funny that the Republicans did everything they could do to exploit his death at the time? Now they ain't got so much to say about Pat Tillman.
No, they don't. And Pat Tillman's father is out there trying to get some of these issues raised, and not with a great deal of success because the media has kind of moved on. But, Joe, you raise a good point. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. This is P.A. Thune in Seattle, Washington. Have I got that right?
It's P.A.than.
P.A.than. I'm sorry. P.A.than.
Yes.
What's up?
I'm calling about a comment you made on Columbus Day.
Yes, sir.
Saying that Columbus discovered America.
Actually, I followed that by saying that we have evidence that the Norwegians were here 1,000 years before Columbus was.
Yes.
And 20,000 to 30,000 years ago, before Columbus was, there were people from Asia who were the original discoverers of North America. We call them Native Americans.
Right. Well, you got to Native Americans, and I was going to compare that statement to something Dick Gregory said when he was a comedian, that he would walk out of a theater and see a Cadillac sitting there and going and getting in the car saying, look what I discovered.
Yeah.
My point is that comparing what Dick Gregory said is what you got to at the end of your statement, that Native Americans were here.
Yeah.
And so Columbus didn't, I said, how could Columbus discover Native Americans when they were already here?
Well, that's what Dick Gregory said so brilliantly on his album, The Light Side, The Dark Side. And Dick Gregory and I traveled to Africa together back in 1981, and I've known him for many years. And he makes the comment, he says, how can you discover a country that's already occupied?
Right.
I mean, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, well, but most people haven't read that as you have and as I have, but I just want to other people in the country or the world, however far your show goes, to give that a thought, that
yeah.
Columbus did not, in fact, discover America.
Yeah, well said. Thank you
okay.
very much for sharing
Thank
that.
You.
My funny Dick Gregory story, the only time I've ever been fired from a job was a radio job. I probably shouldn't even tell this on the air, but I was working at a radio station. I was doing an all-night progressive rock show. And the station had a policy. This was back in the late 60s. The station had a policy during the daytime. It was a top 40 station during the daytime. They had a policy of never playing two blacks back-to-back, never playing two women back-to-back. They didn't want to create a sound, was the theory back then. Bill Drake had come up with this whole format thing. And I was in the studio one night, and we had this absolute maniac who was the guy who ran the station. One of these screamers, shall we say. And I played two black women back to back, frankly, without realizing it. It had just happened. It wasn't so much I was trying to keep to the policy or even violate the policy. I mean, I had a playlist that I was working from. And in any case, he calls me up, Bob. He calls up and he starts yelling and screaming at me and threatening me. And so I just pulled out Dick Gregory's album, The Light Side, The Dark Side. Put it on this is back when it was record players, right? Put it on the turntable and just started playing Dick Gregory. And he calls back and finally I played this for like 2 hours. This is in the middle of the night, and of course it was progressive music album cuts show, but this wasn't even music. This was just Dick Gregory rapping. And finally the engineer shows up and he says, I'm supposed to throw you out. And I says, you want to? And he says, nah. He says, let's just sit around and hang out. But that was my last day at that radio station. Immediately got a job the next day at another one. But the guy who hired me said, I can't imagine anybody working for Bob, as long as you did. I mean, that was pretty impressive. But anyhow, that's my Dick Gregory story number one. Then many years later, when I got to know him, and he was on the board of our program in New Hampshire, and went with me to Africa and whatnot. I told him that story. He thought it was just hilariously funny. So anyway, for what it's worth, I don't know how I got off on that. Speaking of politics, I just very quickly, we're going to take a break in just a second here, but just very quickly, Ted Kennedy now has come out and said that if John Kerry runs for president, you'll notice that a few minutes ago I was endorsing three candidates. John Kerry was not one of them. He says that if Kerry runs against Hillary Clinton, he will support him. And I have to say, if Kerry runs against Hillary Clinton, I will support John Kerry as well. Although I still, to this day, am just tragically disappointed that he didn't fight for Ohio. But I think he's another decent guy. What can I say? I agree with Ted Kennedy. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
Indeed it is.
From those nads in Tiananmen Square.
It's coming, my friends.
It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real. Or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
On its way.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day. From the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming.
You tell him, Leonard, spoken like a good Canadian. But nonetheless, I agree with the sentiment, and democracy is coming to the USA, and you and I are part of making that happen. It's just that simple. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Dylan in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Dylan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, great show. I just wanted to point something out. I'm a friend of Vice President Gore's, and one problem with wire stories is they just get brutally edited, and I don't think a lot of papers ran the full quote from the vice president. It is true he did say that he has no intention of – he said what pretty much all people who eventually run for president say. I have no intention at this point of running. It's not in the – you know, it's not something I'm planning at this point. But then he did go on to say, of course, I don't rule out any possible future interest.
Oh, so great. That's great.
Let's remember that because –
because Al Gore, I mean, he's the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. I would love to see Al Gore run again.
And so would I. You may remember our family. We were the folks from the Seattle area that had the little baby that Al Gore had to help out during the 2000 campaign. And he told our son's story during the convention speech, little kid. That baby who couldn't get nursing care, and he had to intervene to get the HMO to pay up. But we've kept in close touch with Alan Tipper ever since, and our little guy died last year, and Al was the first.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Al was actually the very first person to call when Ian passed on. So we've kept in as close a touch as we can, and my sense has been that he's genuinely and truly undecided. So folks like you and I who would like to see him have one more run at it, we should lean on him a little bit.
Well, we need to start a draft Al Gore for president campaign.
Exactly.
And you know, a great ticket, I think, would be either Al Gore and John Edwards or Al Gore and Howard Dean.
I'm with you. And I run a large website, algore.org, where where people who are interested in seeing him run gather.
That's great.
So let's hope it happens. At this point, I'd say, you know, it's a coin toss whether or not he decides to get in the race or not. But every person who... Every progressive who gets involved and encourages him to run increases the chances, because there's no better candidate, no more qualified person, nobody who knows more about global warming. I mean, what does Katrina shown us?
Oh, I know. I heard him speak here in Portland, Oregon, just a few weeks ago, and it just blew my socks off. He was absolutely brilliant. And, Dylan, anytime anything newsworthy is happening at algore.org, use that as an excuse to call this program and mention that URL one more time, okay?
I'll do it, Tom. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Give us a shout. Thanks. You too. Good to hear from you. Rachel in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Rachel.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to see Al Gore run. Narlodi is here from the chat room.
Oh, great. You know, the chat room was just having a great conversation about, you know, who should be the Democratic candidate. Just a minute ago, I was reading that. By the way, if for folks who want to drop into the chat room, just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you there. Pardon me, Rachel. Go ahead.
I don't know if you've really heard about this, but do you remember the alleged terror attack recently in New York City, in which the mayor pretty much unilaterally declared a state of emergency? There's some speculation on the internet that was actually a hoax that was perpetrated by some sort of government operatives, the purpose of which was to discredit local governments.
Well, that was one theory. My theory on it was, first of all, that the feds fed it to them because Bush had just given a speech in which he said, you need to be afraid, you need to be very afraid, and people weren't afraid. And so he was like, okay, I'll show you how to be afraid. And so he feeds that to Bloomberg. And then Bloomberg is a Republican, and he's running for election, and he says, hey, I can make some political hay with this, because Bloomberg now has almost doubled his lead in the polls as a result of, you know, being firm and decisive, taking on Rudy Giuliani's mantle. We're going to stand up to those terrorists. So it's a hoax that I think worked out for the Republicans all the way down the line, from George Bush all the way down to Bloomberg.
Well, and plus the fact that Bloomberg is a Republican, but he has a Democratic constituency, that's not a situation that, you know, the feds want to see happen.
Yeah.
So, but what I wanted to point out for people is that, you know, when you look at all this stuff that's going on, like the appointing of the Supreme Court justices who believe strongly in increased federal authority, and what's been going on with Halliburton and the disbursement of money, and FEMA, what you see is an overall picture in which individual states are losing rights. It's not just about civil rights being lost, but states' authority.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're seeing the loss of state sovereignty. And then with NAFTA and GATT, you're seeing the loss of federal sovereignty as well. Well said, Rachel. Thank you. Armin in Florida. Braden in Florida. You're going to get the last word today here, Armin. What's up?
Well, I want to talk about our health care system. I mean, it's in my opinion, it's close to the worst in the world, if not effectively, that is.
Well, at least in the developed world.
Right. Correct.
I've been in some pretty grim places, I'll tell you.
No, you
wouldn't want the healthcare system in Peru, for example.
Well, actually,
you may. Actually, they have socialized medicine there, but you wouldn't want the one. Well, anyway, I don't need to start listing countries.
You don't want this one either. If you got anything and you also have a pre-existing condition,
yep,
and you don't have any decent insurance, you wouldn't want this one either.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
Well said.
I look at it like this. I think we have, basically, we have the worst system there is, because what we have is corporate socialized medicine that's brought about by bribery and payoffs. And
yep. And the only...
Huh?
Yep, absolutely. And the only beneficiaries are the corporations. As you say, it's corporate socialized in as much as all of the social wealth is going to the corporations. Well said, Armin. Thank you very much. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to the folks in the chat room. Thanks to Stan and Dan over at Air America mixing the phone lines and whatnot. Thanks to David Poole and Louise here for producing the show. And all of the folks who've called in our stations. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Are you